Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. Today I'd like to give an update, or at least my take, on what's going on with the healthcare repeal-replace debate, whatever you want to call it, and start talking again about solutions, because this is the most confusing thing, I'm sure, for everybody. It's like this energy drain. You think that something's going to happen. There's all sorts of half-truths, partial information, and nothing. At this point, I feel like we're at one of these boxing matches where you have a rope-a-dope. You're just in the corner, and you're just being completely beaten by to a pulp, and you don't know where to turn. It took a couple of days for me to digest what happened with the no vote. I can't say that I'm really surprised. What about you, Dave? Were you surprised that it didn't happen?
No, and it just adds to my frustration and disappointment in the people that we've elected across the board.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, but it did make how the process works pretty naked. I know you heard about the Koch brothers and I think some other moneyed group putting money into the ring to pay to support people to vote against the bill. And if that's the thing that turned this to a no vote for some of these members, that would be, in my opinion, be grounds to remove them. Because obviously their allegiance is not to their constituents. It's to moneyed corporate interest groups, which has always been my argument anyway. And I'm not alone in feeling that Congress does the bidding of whoever pays them the most. And the constituents aren't those people, obviously. We can barely make ends meet, most of us out here. And pouring money into the pot for congressional run is really not a priority for us, but our vote should be. And there seem to have been, I understand people can have a moral, ethical, dilemma and not want to vote for something. But in the scheme of things, if they really, I don't know, if the three-part rollout was really true, and if they did get a letter from the administration stating that we, on our oath, pretty much swear that we will follow through on the things that you want and we promised, I mean, it's like so many levels of chess going on. But I think that ultimately Congress, especially the Speaker, was a victim of their history of promising something and not delivering it, you know, for the most part. At least that was the cover. Well, we don't trust you. We're not going to vote for something because you're just going to do the same thing again. I mean, what's your take on the Republican leadership at this point, if you want to call it that?
I think you summed it up with the last two words. Call it that. Or three words, four words, if you call it that. As old as I am, and I've seen a lot of stuff over many, many years in politics, I've sort of amateur historian, I guess, amateur news person that loves to watch the news and loves to watch things. I have never seen any group like the Republicans continue, they're leaning back in their lounge chair shooting themselves in the foot continually. And they've had an opportunity that they're blowing one more time, in my opinion. And the leadership, both sides of the aisle have forgotten what they're sent there for. They're sent there for the betterment of the USA, not for the betterment of Democrats or Republicans, not for the betterment of themselves, but for us, for our country. And I think they've lost all sight of that. And there is absolutely, in my opinion, no reason that they can't get together and do something.
I think it comes down to, and if it were as easy as you said it was, it would be very easy, because essentially everybody wants the same thing. You want to take, technically, at least from what they state, you want to take care of the people who need the safety net, people with disabilities, seniors, people who don't have economic means. They need to be taken care of. You also don't want to bankrupt the people who are working two jobs, three jobs, just to make ends meet, and they have to decide if they're going to pay a mortgage or pay a premium. Those people need to be taken care of. That's the majority of the country at this point. Those are the people supporting the ones who need it and really being monetized by the people who are at the top of our society economically. There, you know, and all the rhetoric that seems to be pouring out of, you know, various think tanks, D.C., really just keeps the status quo going. It's really interesting when you take your emotion out and you really start looking at the state of play, you know, what really goes on and who stands to gain. You have a whole different take on what's going on. I mean, if the Chamber of Commerce, their whole desire, just like the insurance companies, let's take each in turn. The Chamber of Commerce is designed to help businesses maximize their profits, help them minimize their labor costs, help them corner the market and put their competition out of business, meaning small, medium-sized businesses who don't have a corporate structure where they get to write off and do whatever and not get, you know, payback from the government in various schemes, right? So their desire is to keep status quo. How do they do that? They get in, promote the influx of cheap labor. How do they get that? They promote immigration. These aren't people, I mean, yes, there's two terms of the immigration. You have the HB1 visa crowd who's coming in for the IT in Silicon Valley, the medical profession. You know, they are college-educated and professional class coming in. They do their number on the people who go to college and want to come out and get a job. They're being crushed by these guys who come in for a cheaper paycheck, just happy to be in the United States. So you squeeze one end of our supply to, you know, into the workforce. And on the other end, the unskilled labor side is really getting crushed, where you have people who come in who work off the books. Construction industry is known for that, aren't they? Where you have people, day laborers come in, they do the job, they get a portion or a fraction of what somebody who's a union member who is on the books get, and you get to pocket the rest. So you want as much cheap labor as you possibly can. Of course you want open borders. Of course you want unlimited immigration. And then on the political side, those who are supporting this want to be in power forever. So you get the people to come in, you give them freebies, you promote the illusion that it's going to be awesome once you come over here. I'm not so sure it's awesome necessarily. You're running for, you know, ICE is coming for you. You could potentially be taken advantage of by your employer who doesn't pay you. What are you going to do? Your landlord who may put you in a rat hole. You can't complain because you're not here legally. We already know about the pipeline up where women are literally given contraception because the chance of being raped is so high that it's a priest on the border who literally doles it out against Catholic rules because it's a human rights issue. This is the environment that we are creating: a permanent underclass, a permanent upper class, and then people in the middle who are working, getting crushed on both ends. Who stands to gain? The Democrats are gaining, the Republicans are gaining, the Chamber of Commerce are gaining, and we're left holding the bag. And if you say something, you are racist, sexist, you are just pushed down because you can't speak up. It's not racist or sexist, it's survival. Where do these guys end up? One, nobody knows. That's part of it. Two, they end up in working poor neighborhoods, you know, black neighborhoods, legal immigrant neighborhoods where God knows what happens. The crime rate's through the roof, and they're probably most of them unreported. You name it. It's not a good situation. That's my take on the whole overview. What do you think about that?
Can't argue. As a matter of fact, I think you're seeing it as it is. And the sad part is that it shouldn't just be us talking about it. It should be, the mainstream media should be talking about it. Spicer should be talking about it in news conferences. If I had one or two words to tell the Congress and everybody involved in government, I think it would be grow up. We need to check reality. We need to see. There used to be a show on called Truth or Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we're dealing with today?
Yeah.
They don't want to tell the truth, but we're going to suffer the consequences.
Well, we are suffering the consequences.
And we are, yes.
You know, white wages are depressed. You know, people, apparently, if you have over a $400 bill, and the average person who gets that in the doctor's office has to go into debt to pay it, that's tragic. Yet they're still increasing the out-of-pocket premium costs, or I should say deductibles and coinsurance. What are the insurance companies actually really paying out at this point? The average person is paying, maybe $12,000 for a single policy, just a premium, and then another $5,000, $7,500 out-of-pocket for the deductible. And then the coinsurance kicks in, so they're paying another 20% of the bill. So what is the insurance company really liable for? Most people don't go to the doctor and use their policy. So they literally end up paying their premium and never using it. That's a majority. And I've heard a statistic that will probably really blow your mind, that only 5% of the people account for 50% of the healthcare costs in the country. That's an astounding statistic, mm-hmm. that only 5% of the people are using the system so much that they're taking up a majority of the cost. But that 5% is affecting the other 95% of people who rarely go. So, there's got to be a better way to deliver health care, help the people who actually need the assistance because they're sick, and not have that bleed into the rest of the pool of potential patients. Why is everybody paying for stuff that they never use or won't use or don't have a reason to use? You should pay for what your issue is. If you have mental health issues, your plan should cover that. If you don't, you shouldn't. If you're a man, you shouldn't have to cover maternity costs. If you have no children, you shouldn't have to pay for pediatric dental. There has to be some egalitarian way to do this because everybody's losing. It doesn't make sense because if you're really sick, you end up not being able to afford your cancer drug or your doctor visit, you're still getting squeezed. You're not getting it. And the stories that come out about, everything's awesome since I had Obamacare, I'm sure they exist. I'm not saying that they don't, but I don't believe that that's the majority. I believe there's more people who end up on the outside looking in. They're covered, but they can't use it. Or they're covered, but it's denied. Or the doctor gets held holding the bag where they did it, and then they denied it after the fact. It took me 2 years to get paid for a claim that I followed every single tenant on the pre-certification process. And after all the argument, after 2 years and going up the chain to the federal level, they approved it based on the reason that we said at the beginning. Unbelievable. And only because I was dogged about it that I got my money. So imagine how many doctors don't do that or don't know how to do that across the country. Oh. How much health care is given for free when it's because the insurance company played a game? Nobody talks about that. There's no protection for that. It's really unbelievable.
On that
note, we need to take a break. Let's listen. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. You know, I had a thought while we're in break that we're actually in the midst of what I predicted years ago about Obamacare being a Trojan horse for single payer and how the chaos would unfold, increasing costs, low access, unhappy patients, unhappy doctors, cost going up, and then a clamoring for the government to step in and fix it and wham, single payer. We're already seeing that. I don't know if you saw the article where Bernie Sanders is now going to be the front person. The Democrats are rolling out their alternative to this mess, which is single payer. Did you see that?
I just heard about it. I didn't see it, but I did hear about it.
There you go. It's rolling out as we speak. And I think it's the voices of the unhappy constituents of the Republicans and the so-called conservative press who are all over the Speaker of the House and the Republican Party for causing this fiasco, that they're bringing it back to possibly vote on, you know, change it and vote on it again. I don't know, there's so many levels to this, it's not even funny, but I don't believe that they would have brought it back. And I do think that the Republican, you know, establishment, the GOP, is very much like the Democrats. They want the same thing that they want, but for a different reason, because they're working on the labor side, the Chamber of Commerce side. That's what they're looking at. That's their cohorts that they want to support. And the Democrats are all about, you know, keeping power, expanding their base. And in this case, their base is immigrant population, socialist population, a-religious, meaning no religious affiliation population, and the Muslim community. That's their base, and that's who they're playing to. And they have black, constituents in there, but they're usually, and I believe, taken for granted, just like, oh, they're black, they'll just vote Democratic. So that's the base that we're dealing with, young people who are disaffected and who've gone through our education system and have no idea, except that they know that they're angry, but they don't know why they're angry. That's their population that they're supporting. So you have these two ends of the spectrum, but the bottom line is they both want the status quo and the same movement down this line. Let's talk about single payer, because the people who are coming on saying, we need Medicare for all and it's going to help everybody, really needs a reality check. Because if you look at the National Public Service, the National Health Service in England, there's an article that I have up on my Medicine on Call Facebook page where the NHS boss is asking the formulary the treatment options for patients who have diseases like cancer or chronic pain syndromes to now go over the counter, to get their medications over the counter and cheaper alternatives. So instead of a drug like, it's called fentanyl, which is it's usually used as an anesthetic, but it can be used as a very effective pain medicine for people who have catastrophic and painful end-of-life conditions, you know, end-stage cancer, so on and so forth. They want to take that medicine from these people because it's too expensive and give them things like Tylenol and morphine, which morphine is effective, but it's not a safe drug because if you overuse it, you'll basically die. And Tylenol, we don't even need to talk about that. If you have a chronic pain syndrome, good luck with that. Plus, if you take too much of it, you'll kill your liver. And again, it has a very strict safety profile. And if people are in pain and they're doing it on their own, who knows what will happen to them? You know, it's a situation that can get out of control easily just to save money. So if the National Health Service is so great, single payer is so awesome, why are they having problems with exorbitant, you know, out-of-control costs, rationing? We talked about this before. They actually had a pathway where they were telling doctors and rewarding them monetarily for putting people in a hospice track where they would withhold food and water at the end of or to hasten their demise. And it came out, and people were outraged, and they stopped it. But that kind of situation is what you're – that's the kind of road warrior – healthcare situation that you would get yourself into when you start treating diseases as a cost center and money is the most important thing. If they really had a good system, then they should be able to negotiate their pharmaceutical prices to such a degree that they're not bankrupting themselves, that they're not costing the whole system, you know, millions of pounds. You know, it doesn't work. How can anybody look at that system, or Sweden, where they now have a private track? It's no longer just public medicine. They have a private sector or a private pathway because it didn't work, because people wanted to be treated as individuals, because they wanted to be seen faster, because they wanted more up-to-date medical care. The free market side of it creates innovation, and it promoted a two-tier system. Those who could afford it had the better care. Those who couldn't, didn't. Same thing goes with the British health system. Either you go private or you leave the country. Everybody else who can't afford it stuck in a system where now they're going to be getting morphine or Tylenol instead of a good pain medication to control their pain. And here in the United States, because of Obamacare, the Mayo Clinic has decided that it's going to preferentially take people with commercial insurance versus Medicaid. So we're now creating a two-tier system based on the government control of who wins and who loses. Tell me that's going to be a better idea by privatizing it or making it single payer. I mean, not privatizing, I apologize, but making it a government-based single payer Medicare for all system. Tell me that's going to work. I mean, these are examples that are happening right now. And be careful what you ask for, because when the government gets involved, it tends not to work the way people want it to.
And that's sort of an understatement. Not the way
you're trying to do inflammatory comments on my show. Just read between the lines, but yeah, it's you know, they write a law. I was watching the confirmation of the Supreme Court this past week, and the thing that he came back to saying is, you know, you're not happy with the way I interpreted the law. Write a new one. So he said, you know. And I agree with them. They write these rules. Maybe they're in good intention. Maybe. Who knows? The Stark Law for medical doctors. We're not allowed to have any perceived fiduciary interest in any kind of test or lab or surgery that we recommend to a patient. It's the assumption that if you own the surgery center, or if you have an interest in the radiology center or whatever it is outside the hospital, that somehow you're in line to cheat the patient. It didn't look at the fact that everything outside the hospital setting is cheaper than what you get in the hospital. We'll talk about that in a second. It didn't take into account that you can't just do a procedure or order a test without a reason to do it, because of the guidelines from your surgical medical society, because of standard of care, because of all these things in place to keep you from just doing surgery and surgery and ordering test after test. What it happens that you see the fraud in is the government side, where the government checks nothing, where you order things within the Medicaid system, and then Medicaid mills and people who open up little post office boxes where they cheat the system. That doesn't happen on the private side, because you are much more attuned to the consumer and to actually offering a service and actually having a value that the patient perceives, because if they don't, they will not come to you. If you have a bad reputation for doing too many surgeries or not having good outcomes, you will be out of business faster than you can say boo. But what happens when the government gets involved? It promotes mediocrity. It promotes the machine to continue to run without any kind of thought to it. It's just a means to an end in itself. And it's not responsive to patient needs or doctor needs. It's all about feeding the beast. And that beast usually is these entities that attach themselves to the system. I'm sorry to digress, but the IT, the whole information technology sector comes to mind when I think about that. They wrote a bill called HITECH that every doctor's office, every hospital is supposed to go on electronic medical records, and they were supposed to have interoperability, meaning that they could talk to each other. So if you left your doctor's office, you went across the country, that doctor could look you up in the information technology, the electronic health record, find your labs, find your CTs, find everything they needed, and it would be at their fingertips. It's now, 7 years after that law passed, it's still not in place. So if you have, and then, you know, patient leaves, I saw a patient who moved from Michigan. She doesn't have access to her records. I can't get them. We still have to call the doctor to figure it. Hopefully, they'll release them, and we'll get them in a timely way. So here's a law that only benefited the IT people, the people who are making these EHRs, who it's in their interest not to have interoperability because it puts you in the position where you need them, where you can't leave as a vendor, you know, that particular vendor and go to someone else because you don't have access to your own healthcare information.
Dr. George,
I got to throw in. I'll take a break.
That's okay. I was going to throw in a quick comment.
Go ahead.
When we got into and we were talking about this the other day, when computers started coming along and everybody started using one in business or at home or whatever the case might be, what was one of the old sayings that came along with it? Garbage in, garbage out?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and I'm not saying this in all cases by any means, and there are certainly well-meaning doctor's offices and assistants and all of this, but you get somebody that's having a bad day and doesn't care, and mm-hmm. she's in charge or he's in charge of the input on patient records, it doesn't take a whole lot to screw up the last four digits of the Social Security number or the person's mm-hmm. name or age or whatever. And what have you got? Garbage in, garbage out? And you can't, you know, it's a system. They keep forgetting about, or government does, that everything's great until you add that one factor, humans.
Very true. Excellent point. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. You know, we were speaking prior to the break about, you know, the information in your electronic medical record potentially has the ability to be hacked. It can, and it will, follow you for the rest of your life. And one wrong input, one wrong medication, one wrong assessment or conclusion, it's all digitized, right? We're talking about an electronic medical record system where there's a coding system associated with it. Now we're in the ICD-10 version. There's an 11, I found out, that's coming, which supposedly is supposed to make it better, but, you know, it'll probably add more codes and make it more specific. And it gives a very good picture of the patient. Everything you put in there, and maybe you don't know, I've said it before, but I'll repeat, is not locked in the doctor's office. It's on a cloud. So when that doctor's electronic medical record is, when you send or close that chart, it's held in a cloud by the vendor, the electronic medical record company. As you transmit that information to the insurance company for the coding and the billing, that information is sifted through by a ton of different agencies. For Obamacare recipients, it's going through the IRS. It's going to the FBI because of fraud, potential fraud. If you're getting a subsidy, they want to make sure that you are economically it's appropriate that you have the subsidy. If your condition changes, I mean, everything is locked in a grid. If you make more, I've said it before, just to repeat, unless you, in case you forgot, if you get a subsidy and you make more money the next year, they claw back the subsidy. It's not a gift. It's a loan. It's not really just for your money. It's the government helping you. And what they give, they can definitely and have taken away. So you add that to the database of the meaningful use, which is part of the value-based medicine that got rolled out within the last 2 or 3 years, where the doctor, the physician assistant, the intake, the person taking the information, has to now have a lot more information about you. How many people live in your home? Have you ever tried to hurt yourself? Do you have guns in your home? Where are the guns? If you're a pediatrician, if your child believes he or she is a boy or a girl, all of these things are now been captured in a metadata system. And it's not just data. It's linked to you. You're not, you know, anonymous. They can go back and figure out who's who and what's what. So when you go into potentially, I don't know, it may even be happening as we speak. And I think it did happen at one point that seniors who were receiving Social Security, who had guns in their home, it was a database that they had, and they were removing guns from the homes of seniors because of, or not receiving their Social Security unless they can remove the guns. It was this behavioral system based on information that they had received from the doctor. So the doctor became an agent for the government by providing information. And in some cases, and I've been in a situation where you're in a hospital, you can't close the chart unless you answer those questions. You can't go to the next screen. You can't say not applicable. You can say no. And again, how much information are you getting that's true, really? Do people do things just to close the chart? Do they make up things? Do they not ask the patient, not really know the answer, but put it into something in anyway, just so they can close the chart? These are the things that people don't take into consideration, and that's where the individual or the human error side of it come into play. And how many doctors or people inputting the information know that in order to code properly, they have to put in something because that's what the hospital demands in order for their productivity to be X, Y, and Z. But there's so many things that are against patient care or potentially conflict of interest that people should really start discussing. Who owns your information? Let's say we do go to an interoperability and all of your health information is on a huge database that it can be linked across the country. What happens if that gets hacked? It happens every day. Does somebody now lock out the entire healthcare IT system? Does somebody go in and look for, you know, people of a certain economic strata to blackmail them? You know, the possibilities are endless, honestly.
Dr. George?
Where there's a will, there's a way, yes.
I've got a question for you. Wouldn't you say, the old saying is knowledge is power? Is that...
Absolutely.
Is that what... Okay, now, here we are in the good old USA. We're talking about something sort of in the unbelievable, but it's happening with our medical records. And we know that China, Russia, North Korea, anybody else can hack into our records.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask, does Russia have electronic medical records, or China, or North Korea? Is anybody else mm-hmm. in the world have them except us that are vulnerable to being hacked? And they could say, okay, the USA has X number of people through electronic medical records that are smokers or that are drinkers mm-hmm. or that are this or that. And how do we play this? How do we use this knowledge to destroy America?
Well, it can definitely be used against you.
The
most innocent thing is, you know, you get locked out. The most nefarious thing is you use that against people. And hospitals all over the country have actually been hacked. Their patient charts have been locked, and they have to pay a ransom to get the their health information for their hospital back online.
We worry.
It's not advertised, but it happens all the time.
We worry about Russia, quote unquote, being involved or trying to twist the election. Well, I haven't heard anybody bring up the fact that if Russia hacked into the EMR of a candidate and then contacted that candidate, you know, if you keep running for office, we're going to disclose that you have two left toes.
Right. Uh-huh.
So why aren't we talking about this? Why isn't this? I mean, if we have it, why doesn't, you know, does Russia have electronic medical records? I doubt it.
You know, I don't know. I haven't looked at the other countries, you know, who have a national health system and their database, but they do transmit their information to the World Health Organization. So there has to be some mechanism of getting this information, because that's population health. That's what the World Health Organization trades in. And that information is gathered. Now, what they're trying to do, or have what we're trying to do, where you have a central brain where everything can intercommunicate, I don't know about that. I have to look that up, but it's not a great idea based on what we know about the ability for the various, you know, electronic systems to be hacked, whether that's Yahoo, whether that's Google, whether that's, I mean, everybody's had AT&T, you name it, some entity online has had an episode where they've been hacked, and in some cases they've been blackmailed in order to keep their systems open. And it's happened to friends of mine where they, you know, you get this thing that comes up on your screen, call this number, your computer's not working, and you call the number, you end up having to pay like a couple thousand dollars to get it unhooked. They just stopped doing it so much from an individual standpoint and went to where the money is, which is hospitals. I wonder if it ever happens with the government. I mean, it's all these things that it's not safe. I mean, we've proven this. If this whole election debacle is an example of nobody's safe, why would we want to put everything on the computer?
You got me.
I have a question about that, right? It makes sense. I mean, this is the most personal thing about you is your health. Why should anybody except you and your doctor have access to it? We've already shown that it's not safer. It doesn't make the doctor more efficient. You still make errors. They're just different medical errors. And there's somebody making money on it. The doctor and the patient have been monetized in this system. The patient, through their buying insurance and not being able to use it, by having a cost shifting, so they have the privilege of carrying a piece of plastic, but does it really serve them when they really need it? So they've been monetized. The doctors have been monetized by entering this grid of electronic medical record system, having to get a vendor, having to code a certain way in order to get paid. It's a rat race. You spend so much time pursuing numbers, treating by numbers, you know, seeing how you compare to your colleagues on these arbitrary, you know, measuring scales of who's more productive, who orders the least tests, who orders the cheapest medications. You know, all these things are just data points. But are we better? Are we safer? Are we healthier? It seems to me that we're not, overall. It's not really working. And doing more of the same thing doesn't make it better, but it does make someone rich.
Mm-hmm. Like you've always said, follow the money.
Exactly. And on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. I'm sorry, go off tangent a little bit, but I think you just need to understand, you know, the bigger picture. You know, I spend all day trying to figure out, and as every doctor in this country, how to take the best care of my patient in a cost-effective manner, in an efficient manner, where they're getting their money's worth and their value, and they're getting better. It's gotten to the point now, if you have a patient with an insurance plan you are handicapped as a physician. You're not able to do the bare minimum without some hurdle, without some frustration, without the patient basically saying, I can't do it. I mean, I can't even provide allergy treatment for a patient because that's not covered under that patient's insurance, and the patient needs it. So now that patient is going to have to be on medication, over the counter for the rest of her life. That's more money to spend, a longer period of time than having a 2 or 3 year commitment to fix the problem and be off of that. I mean, there's no common sense in this. And that's where patients now have to become educated consumers. Free market medicine is such a generic term. I think it's been demonized by this whole healthcare repeal fiasco because it makes it sound like it's more expensive, that people are, it only helps the rich, that it's somehow bad for poor people. It's completely opposite. Free market medicine is consumer-based medicine. That's where you know the cost of something, rich or poor. You can take that and compare it to another place that's providing the service, and then you get to make up the decision about which one you want to use. What is wrong with that? I don't care if you're on Medicaid, Medicare, or the best PPO plan, or you can afford to pay whatever it is out of pocket. Everybody benefits from a system like that. And under the Affordable Care Act, what we've gotten is the less choice. I know that Obamacare is not going anywhere. I'm not so sure all this talk is going to bear out any fruit. I hope it does. But I know that there's no way if they keep the main tenets, which is covering your kid until they're 26 and having mandated insurance coverage for whatever medical problem that the government deems should be covered, those two tenets in themselves will never bring the cost of healthcare down, the cost of insurance down, the cost of access down, because those are the two main drivers of the cost. You have people who are 26 on their parents' plan. They're not paying for a policy. It's the young, healthy people that keep the cost down. So you've lost a majority of people, if they're doing that, who otherwise could make the cost for over everybody else cheaper. So that's a lose. Then you add in all these things that need to be covered. Why do these things need to be covered exactly if you don't need them? Why can't people have choice about what level of coverage they want, whether that be just cover me in case I get hit by a bus versus I want everything and I'm willing to pay for everything, but I want everything? How do you take that choice out of the situation, give everybody the most expensive, coverage, technically? You have to have the most offerings in your coverage, but you have to have skin in the game because the cost is shifted to you. So you end up paying for things that you're never going to use. It's a tax, ultimately. And until that's changed, they're talking nonsense. They need to actually get rid of the mandate, allow people to leave it if they want to or they can't afford it. And once that happens, the insurance companies will be forced, if they want the business, if 24 million people are leaving the insurance plans, then the insurance company will be motivated to make cheaper policies that will draw those people back. By definition, that will be the fastest way to open up the insurance market, technically, for people who can't afford it. But what's wrong with that? Having a safety net with Cadillac stuff that people don't need makes no sense. It's just, I don't know what their motivation is on that. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. Other standpoint is the pharmaceutical side of it. All they would have to do is benchmark it. I've talked to a doctor at a conference, and I'm hopefully going to have her on our show, who has a brilliant idea. We know that it's cheaper in Canada. We know it's cheaper in the UK. Drugs are cheaper. We know all of these things. Why are we paying so much? Because we're subsidizing them. And the key to this would be to benchmark it. You look at the cost of all the medicines for the different countries. You pick the lowest one, and you basically say, we're paying that rate for the government to say, or maybe 1% more than what they're paying. then you've just eliminated this graft system that the pharmaceuticals companies are using against us. Once the price of medicine comes down, that's a boon for patients, whether they're rich or poor, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare. As long as somebody's paying for something and it's not you, it's going to be expensive, it's going to be, you know, hard to navigate, it's going to be this, and it's not going to get better. I mean, those are simple things you can do, right? You can allow people to have health savings accounts that they can use, take that money, save it, and use it for whatever medical thing that they want to use it for. Not just if you have insurance, that's the only way you can use it, that's ridiculous. Use it for direct primary care, use it for medical tourism, use it to pay cash to your direct pay doctor, whatever you want to use it for. It's your business because it's your money. It should be tax deductible or should be, and should be tax free. You should be able to pass it to your kid. End of story. You should put as much money as you want to. You should encourage people to handle their own business instead of somebody telling you what you can and cannot have. How hard is that? Is that really hard, Dave?
Not at all. And I couldn't agree with you more. And if, you know, the unfortunate thing is, though, I might save a chunk or save what I believe I might need down the road and cover my tail. But it's the guy across the street that says, you know, I'll let somebody else pay for it in their taxes or something else. That's where, you know, I don't like to use the word penalty, but it comes back to people. There are a lot of people that wouldn't aggressively build a health savings account and think, well, I'll just let the government pay for it.
Well, at this point, they're going to get substandard care because the people who are handling their business are going to be seen, if they just choose a direct primary care doctor, $60 a month and see their doctor for as many times as they need to see them and get dispensed medication from the office for maybe $5. They're going to be getting a different standard of care than the one who enters the system where it's one size fits all. All the ills that we just spoke about in the show, that applies to that person who wants someone to take care of them because you're not going to be happy with it. So there is a risk to doing that. There is a consequence to doing that. So I think that would actually encourage people not to do that if you really think about it.
Hopefully. And I'm all for it. I think the health savings account is absolutely the way to go for everybody. In fact, we have one, and we're whether we call it that or not, we have a savings account that's dedicated to our health. That if we have to pay a deductible, it comes out of that savings account. If we have to pay this or we have to pay that, it comes out of that account.
Well, the only gift, in theory, you're doing pretty well, but you can't use it to pay your premiums. You can't use it to see a doctor out of network, right? If it's not covered by your insurance company, you can't apply it. Those are the things that need to be unlocked so that people have really, it's like having your own cash that you can do whatever you want with medically. That's all. That's the tweak that I would make because it's a good thing in theory, but in practice, it does have too many limitations. That's all. That would be my fix for that.
Well, but the government looks at it like you're not smart enough to control your own.
That's the major problem.
Yeah.
They think we're stupid. But it's up to us to make our voices heard, right? So whether you're on the left side of it or the right side of it, you have to make your voice heard because they will make choices for you. And they're not in your best interest. And I'm going to be charitable. It's because they don't know, right? Who's up there in Capitol Hill doing these the testimonies? It's the pharma, big pharma. It's the corporate interests that run it. It's never really the patient. It's not the doctor. And that's who needs to be up there to let them know your law, even though it's meant to be good, it's being applied in a way that's punitive. It's not helping us. We need X, Y, and Z. Unless we get up there and say that, and with the caveat, if you don't do what I'm asking or if you don't listen to me, I will not be voting for you. That has to be the second sentence out of your mouth. in order to get them to play ball. If you just go up and say, please, may I, that's not happening. There has to be a consequence for them. And the only consequence they understand is, you're not getting my vote.
Yep.
That's a big, powerful thing that we have. We never use it.
You know, with that being said, are dentists liable for EMR as well?
Who is?
Pardon me? Are dentists in the EMR system as well?
I don't think so. They generally aren't.
With your specialty, you have to cross paths on occasion. Because sometimes, and correct me if I'm not a doctor, not trying to play doctor, but sometimes a toothache can actually be a sinus infection, can it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can.
So I go to the dentist with a toothache, but it's not really a toothache. So wouldn't it make sense to have doctors and dentists coordinate as well?
Everybody across the healthcare profession, yeah. And a lot of dentists don't take insurance, so they're out of the loop. You know, you have to pay them cash.
Yeah.
Or you have to have a dental policy if you have one of those. But they're kind of not within this grid. But you made a very important point. The risk of healthcare delivery in our country is borne by the doctor. And that is the major problem. So I gave an example when we were off break. I changed my electronic medical record vendor. And in order to leave the vendor that I had, they wanted me to pay them $10,000 to capture my information, all the data for my patients, put it into a format that I could transfer it to the next vendor. So they basically owned my medical information, and I was held hostage. I found another way around it. It took a while to do it. But $10,000, are you kidding me? There should not be a cost like that.
No.
To transfer your health information if you decide to choose vendors. And if they got hacked, or let's say I got hacked, through no fault of my own because their cloud was breached, I am, as a physician, on the hook for that information of the patient getting out and for breaking HIPAA. That is ridiculous. You promised me an EMR that was safe and secure. You should bear the cost and the risk for what happens. The insurance companies do the exact same thing.
We're going to have to wind it up on that.
I'm sorry?
We're out of time.
Oh, my gosh. That was fast. I never do that. But I'll have to, you know, bring this back on a different show so people can understand what they're up against. Anyway, thank you for listening to Medicine on Call, and I will see and talk to you next week.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.